Now, I want to set this next practice up because we've been doing it, but I want to talk a little bit more about it. This is the next practice. You will notice the sequence of the breaths will be very similar to the last sequence, but now we'll be concentrating in a very different way. We'll be working with the earth, water, fire, Murshid Karim Bashvedevan from Holland. It is upon one's attitude that one's whole life depends. By attitude, one achieves desirable or undesirable results. Generally, the whole difficulty in life of a person is that he's not master of his own attitude. And however learned, however intelligent, or however spiritual a man may appear to be, if he has no control over his attitude and no insight into the result of that attitude, he's not gone very far on the path. Although a right attitude is an inborn quality, it can be changed and developed. The right mind has a right attitude, and a wrong mind has a wrong attitude. Sometimes the mind gets into a crooked or awkward position. It is not in its right place, and then whatever a person sees seems wrong to him.
What was that last sentence?
And then whatever a person sees seems wrong to him. You know that? It's like sometimes you just feel like, I've got a bad attitude today.
Yeah.
And everything just seems wrong, right? Well, and again, you know, just naming it, it's like, you know, tomorrow that's going to pass, hopefully, you know. And whatever he does turns out to be wrong. And in some people's lives, this happens very often. In others, only at times. In Sanskrit, there is a saying that when a bad time comes in one's life, the mind changes its attitude. But he who looks at the mind as a compass, which always points in the right direction, and who continues to believe in this, will always find the right attitude. And in other places in the teachings, Murshid says, making the right of the wrong and the wrong of the right. You know, the things aren't always just one way. They can't be. And once a person has a key in his attitude in life, then everything can be of use to him. As, for instance, humility and pride. The one who has humility as his principle is incapable of pride. And the one who has pride as his principle is incapable of humility. One lacks the right leg and the other the left. And in both cases, something is missing. I hope you're hearing this, because we a lot of times want to walk around with our heads in our lap. And there is a time when humility wins, when humility raises one's position, when it melts hearts, when it is the greatest virtue in man's life. And at such times, it is a serious fault if humility is missing. But then there is a time when pride has its place, when pride has to perform a role, when it raises a person, or when it sustains him. And at that time, he is lost if he practices the principle of humility. Therefore, it is not the principle, it is making use of the principle. Which is the main thing. Do you understand? So again, we can say, of course, yes, it's important to balance all these things, but sometimes we have to have fire. And sometimes we have to have air. And sometimes we have to have earth. You've just stepped into the middle of it, haven't you? But you understand what I'm saying. We're becoming masters of these things. I mean, you can't walk into a, you know, a tiger's cage with a, an animal crafter and think you're going to tame that tiger. You better have a chair and a whip and a fast escape if you need it. You understand what I'm saying? So, and I love this. It's a Sufi story, beautiful Sufi story, and it maybe finds its way through other traditions, but it was the story of this snake. It was a poisonous snake. And this snake had, done terrible things. It had bitten all these people and killed these people and animals and all kinds of things, and it was repentant. And it went to the Sufi teacher and said, I really feel I have done some real wrong in my life, and I would really like to, I really need to make amends. I have to get on the right path, and will you teach me? And so the teacher said, well, of course, and, just don't go around biting people and killing them. You can be gentler with people. And so the snake went away for some time, and when it returned, I'll tell you, the snake was in really bad shape. Like, he had gashes, and he was open, and he was wounded, and he was, like, barely could slither up. And the Sufi teacher said, my God, what has happened to you? And the snake said, well, you told me not to bite people. And he said, I told you not to bite people. I didn't tell you couldn't hiss. Get it? So we can't just always be one way, and not every situation calls for the same response. But if we're awake, that's what enlightenment is, being awake. We awake so we can respond. And sometimes with children, we have to be harsh. Do that, or else you're going to have a consequence. If you don't do that, what do they become?
Spoiled.
Yeah. Or worse, sometimes. Criminals.
Steph, if we breathe in humble and exhale meek, is that better than breathe in humble and exhale pride for our practicing breath?
I love this quote of my godmother. You're going to laugh. It just tells you a little bit of her temperament. God rest her soul. She died a few weeks ago. Her name's Martha Fox. We'll mention her name. She said, the meek shall inherit the earth if they don't get pushed off at first.
But not the mineral rights, right? I like the Bible's quote, he who exalts himself shall be abased, he who abases himself shall be exalted.
Yeah, but then again, this ties into this teaching. Yeah. You see, if I'm trying to offer encouragement to people, I can do that with a certain humility. There is a skill for that because it makes people feel very open, and that someone is very, not me, let's just say anyone. If someone's very humble, then people feel relaxed and they feel open and they feel they can trust that person. But at the same time, if there has to be a time where someone can come forward in a more dynamic way, let's say. You might call that pride, but we'll just call it dynamic. That can encourage people. There has to be an energy that can also rise people, raise them up. You know what I'm saying? It's all balance. I just don't think that it's that simple. I mean, if it was, we'd all be enlightened.
Well, I think a Hillary politician type turns people off her audacious arrogance.
We won't talk about
no.
politics.
No.
How about a little different frame of reference from a traditional perspective. Does everybody know what a Tai Chi is? It's the symbol of the Tao. Mm-hmm. And what the two halves mean, the black swirl and the white swirl, don't forget that within each one of them, there is a certain amount of essence of the other. There's a black dot within the white swirl. There's a white dot within the black swirl. And they're there for a reason, because it's an ever-moving cycle that yang becomes yin, yin becomes yang. They're interdependent and interrelated to each other. And with each one, there is yang within yin and yin within yang. And so you can't have just either humility or pride. There's some striking of a balance, whether it's kind of a dominant of one swing of the pendulum or a dominance of the other swing of the pendulum, the other direction, there's still a balance of each within whichever direction it's going. The pendulum itself is still there. That's an ever-changing dynamic.
So don't get stuck in the idea of being in one state. Get hung up on the idea of the dynamic, maybe. You know, and that things are ever changing. The only thing that's constant is change.
So just while we're here in this text, I also felt, and you know, maybe it seems a little disjointed, but I have to, this is such a beautiful story because it has to do, it's a teaching on the ego. So while we're talking about this, am I this way or that way, or should I be this way or that way? Maybe we could reflect on this little story. It's beautiful. We read in the 10th Sufi thought that perfection is achieved by annihilation of the false ego. Maybe this is also what you're referring to, Diane. You know, the false ego is what does not belong to the real ego, and what that ego has wrongly conceived to be its own being. When that is separated by analyzing life better, then the false ego is annihilated. Sometimes the false ego could be referred to as a personality or the kind of constructs around the personality, you see. So we're trying to, again, sort of polish the mirror of the heart so we have a clear reflection of the inner state. A person does not need to die for it. In other words, you don't have to give up everything, what you are. In order to annihilate this body, in order to annihilate this mind, a person has to analyze himself and see, what does I, in quotes, stand? Where does I stand? Does it stand as a remote, exclusive being? If it is a remote and an exclusive being, then it must be found out. The whole spiritual process is to find this out. To thine own self be true. Know thyself, and thou shalt know God. You see? Once this is realized, the work of the spiritual path is accomplished. As in order to make the eyes see themselves, one has to make a mirror to see the reflection of these eyes. So in order to make this real being manifest, this body and mind have been made as a mirror. That in this mirror, this real being may see itself and realize its being is independent. What we have to achieve by the path of initiation, by the way of meditation, by spiritual knowledge, is to realize this by making ourselves a perfect mirror. And this analogy comes up again and again. You see, a mirror, when we look at that mirror, that mirror is empty. There's no quality or character to that mirror. But the images that become before it are reflected in it. Does the mirror say, I'm that? Yes, that's what we do. You see, but we're trying to understand that we're beyond that. That we're not the reflections that are coming at us. Or even the reflections that we make within ourselves. Again, that's another meaning of emptiness. When we remove all those things, something else entirely different becomes reflected. If I stand before that, does that mirror say I'm Nuria? And then I go away, what is it? Do you kind of understand the metaphor? So here we go, here's a sweet little story. In order to explain this idea, this story has been told. A lion roaming through the desert found a little lion cub playing with sheep. It so happened that the little lion had been reared with the sheep. and so had never had a chance or an occasion to realize what he was. You see, we're those little lion cubs. We're raised in a certain way, and we forget who we are. Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you understand what's being said here? The lion was greatly surprised. God's greatly surprised. Divinity's greatly surprised. Whatever you want to place here. To see a young lion cub running away with the same fear of the lion as the sheep. Mm-hmm. Running away from who we really are. There's that quote, and it's been attributed to many people, from Nelson Mandela, Mandela to Marianne Williamson, but it's the quote, the problem is that they're not, somebody help me with that, that they're afraid of their own greatness. Something like that, you see, and here's the same point. The lion was greatly surprised to see a young lion cub running away with the same fear of the lion as the sheep. He jumped in front of the flock of the sheep and roared, "Halt! Halt!" But the sheep ran on, and the little lion ran also. The lion pursued only the cub, not the sheep. And said, "Wait, I wish to speak to you." The cub answered, "I tremble, I fear, I cannot stand before you." "Why are you running about with the sheep? You're a little lion yourself." "No, I am a sheep. I tremble, I'm afraid of you. Let me go with the sheep." Anyone hear the story knocking from within? And then the lion says, "Come along. Come with me. I will take you and I will show you what you are before I let you go." Trembling and yet helpless, the little lion cub followed the lion to a pool of water. There the lion said, "Look at me and look at yourself. Are we not closer? Are we not near? You are not like the sheep. You are like me." Through the whole spiritual process, what we learn is to disillusion this false ego. The annihilation of this false ego is its disillusionment. When once it is disillusioned, then the true ego realizes its own merit. It is this realization that the soul enters the kingdom of God. It is in this realization that the soul is born again, a birth which opens the doors of heaven. And this is from one of the Sufi sayings, the complete sayings of Hazrat Inayat Khan. The false ego is a false god. When the false god is destroyed, the true God arrives. We're going to do one more reading and then we're going to do these breaths. And this breath is from a text called Glimpse After Glimpse by Sogyal Rinpoche. They're daily reflections, and I love that title so much because meaning, you know, and we've all had that. We've all had those moments of clarity. You know, we get a glimpse. And so this is like glimpse after glimpse. And I'm pretty much convinced that enlightenment is just the gaps between the glimpses just get smaller. And we're kind of just glimpsed, you know. So this is actually from today, February 23rd. And I receive these via email. If anyone else is interested, you can just go to rigpa.org and sign up. Here's the reading for today. Everything that we see around us is seen as it is because we have repeatedly solidified our experience of inner and outer reality in the same way, lifetime after lifetime. And this has led to the mistaken assumption that we see this objectively real. And what we see is objectively real. In fact, as we go further along the spiritual path, we learn how to work directly with our fixed perceptions. All of our old concepts of the world, or of matter, or even ourselves are purified and dissolved. And an entirely new, what you could call heavenly, field of vision and perception opens up. As William Blake said, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear as it is, infinite. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear as it is, infinite. You might call the etheric element that element of being infinite. So, anyone that's interested in hearing Pura Murshid Hidayat Inayat Khan's teachings on the elements should go to www.sufimovement.us and go to, it's called
audio teachings,
because he gives us the teaching of these elemental breaths that we're now going to share together. And what he talks about this is that these are, he uses them as a method of purification and clarifying too, didn't he, in that teaching? Do you remember Karima Gita and Joe?
I didn't hear.
He used it as a method of describing how we can clarify our perceptions, didn't he? Mm-hmm. So he talks about, the fact is that by doing these practices every day, we become masters of the elements, and we can use them to balance ourselves, but what's more, we can use them to purify these things that we have solidified to be truths. Oh, this is where I can give my public service announcement as everybody's getting their pencil and pen out. We have put together for your benefit, how do they do that on those home shopping networks? For the simple price of $20 for the packet, let me just tell you what's in this packet.
But wait, there's more.
And yeah. There is more.
And there's a heart and wings on the top of every page.
Yeah, that top of every page, that beautiful symbol. And references. Okay, so we have the Sufi Invocation, which we said at the beginning, a paper called The Path of Initiation by Pura Murshid Hidayat Inayat Khan, and a paper on studentship, which we call Muridship, by Hazara Inayat Khan. And then we have all the prayers that we say throughout the day and the meaning of the gestures of the prayers from a lecture from August 27th, 1926, the year before Pura Murshid Hazara Inayat Khan passed. And we have all the prayers. We have all the motions of the prayers because the path is integrated with shift in consciousness by various gestures. It's kind of like Maha Mudra, you might say. Mm-hmm. The mudras, but the body is also in mudra, not just the hand gestures. Very simple. And then we also have, I hope this is a complete packet, this beautiful prayer called Niyaz. It's a purification prayer. Mm-hmm. And purification breaths are in here, which are different than the purification elemental breaths that we're going to be practicing. And there's a series of other breath practices in here that I've also taught, and then there's a whole reference guide online, links to online teachings and resources. So that is available. We try to make that available to people so that they can have the teachings. Sometimes things slip through the cracks as we're doing the practice, but this is to use as a study guide.
What was the name of the book that you referenced that could be purchased on Amazon?
Heart of Sufism. The Heart of Sufism.
Rigpa.
R-I-G-P-A dot org.
That's SufiMovementUSA.org.
SufiMovement.us for United States. Waiting for Joe to come back. Is he doing something with the dog? Or? I actually think what I would like to do is I'd like to do a series of three breath practices so you can experience the uniqueness of each. I know sometimes when we're given instruction within our community, there's sometimes been... Well, I'll even say it about myself. When I was initially given the practices, it was not through my teacher, Murshita Vira. She left it to someone else to give me some of these initial practices, and they weren't transmitted in the way that Hazrat and I meant them. So I'm not saying that any of us have done anything wrong. Of course, everything's a benefit, but I truly believe that if we can reflect upon the ways in which the teachings were originally given, there's a great benefit.
Okay?
So... I'm going to refer back to this little study guide booklet, and I'm going to read directly from, instead of doing the elemental breath straight away, I'd like to do the purification breaths. Okay. And I read this again and again, first of all, because I never tire of hearing it, and I feel constantly inspired by these words of Hazrat and Icon, and I think it also gives a good ground for the practice. So this practice is typically done in the morning before breakfast, and it can be done sitting or standing, or it could even be done if we were not feeling well lying in bed. This is called the purification breaths, and I'll give you instructions. He says the inhalations and exhalations are done rhythmically in a restful, quiet manner. Slower than the usual breath, yet slightly fuller. So this is not an etheric breath. This is not a very shallow breath. It's a full, active breath. It is important to discover the natural rhythm of one's breath. While inhaling and exhaling, one's thoughts are focused on receiving. So inhaling, on receiving. And when we exhale... on radiating. Do you understand? Again, this is that kind of contraction and expansion. You can open your eyes for a moment and watch what I'm doing here. So we're breathing in and we're drawing into ourselves. And when we breathe out, we expand and we release. Okay? So on the in-breath, we're receiving. And on the out-breath, we're radiating. And what are we doing? So he says, when inhaling and exhaling, one's thoughts are focused on receiving and radiating divine power in space, which purifies and revivifies, and which inspires and enables the soul to unfold. How extraordinary is that, if you think of it? The thoughts are focused on receiving. So as we breathe in, receiving, and as we breathe out, then we transmute that, and we radiate divine power in space, which purifies and revivifies and which inspires and enables the soul to unfold. When we inhale, we concentrate on these words. I inhale divine light, L-I-G-H-T, and life. And when we breathe out, we concentrate on these words. I radiate the same. And he does say that this exercise is the basis of many esoteric practices and should be mastered before one can understand further mysteries. So when we do our daily practices, those of us that have been guided to do so, it begins with the invocation. We said the prayer in the beginning, and one moves into this practice. So, again, the breath will be on your own rhythm. It's important, as he said, to discover your own rhythm, and it is slightly fuller than the normal breath. You may want to think of this as an internal yoga process, so that the breath is actually involved in nurturing and massaging all the internal spaces, from the physical to the more subtle. So we start with breathing in the nose and out the nose. The breath is in the nose and out the nose. And we concentrate when we breathe in on the phrase, I inhale divine light and life. When we breathe out, I radiate the same. And one can feel very involved in this practice, as if each cell, each molecule, the very fiber of our being, from the most material to the most spiritual, is inhaling divine light and life, and then radiating it on the out-breath. And typically this is done in a series of 5 breath cycles. So one inhale and exhale is one. So if you were doing this on your own, you would just do 5 breaths in the nose and out the nose. The next breath is in the nose and out the mouth. In the nose, breathing in, I inhale divine light and life, and out the mouth, I radiate the same. And while the breath is full, it's also inaudible, so it's very controlled. You see, understanding mastery of the breath, everything starts to come under that element of mastery. The mind, the body, the emotions. And now the breath turns and we breathe in the mouth and out the nose. So breathing in through the mouth, I inhale divine light and life. And out the nose, I radiate the same. The next breath is in the mouth and out the mouth, and we inhale divine light and life, and we breathe out, I radiate the same. And really, when you draw in, like you're drawing in all the light of the universe, from the far reaches of the universe, you're absorbing that divine light and life. Radiate, we're just shining, radiating light outward. In the mouth and out the mouth. This concludes that aspect of the teaching in terms of the purification breath, but it goes on, and here again we're given this teaching by pure immersion. So stay with the breath, don't sort of lose that rhythm, because I'll just read a little bit and we'll do a concluding practice that is sort of intended to be in association with this purification breath, and it's called the healing prayer. Or the term Nyas is given to this prayer. Again, the practice can be done standing, sitting, or lying, but it is done in threes. And I will say the words. Now the breath closes the cycle. It is once again in the nose and out the nose. And some of you know these phrases, but for those that don't, I'll say the prayer. So begin with an exhalation and breathe breathe in the nose as you're thinking these words. Beloved Lord Almighty God. And then breathe out. Through the rays of the sun. And breathe in. Through the waves of the air. And breathe out. Through the all-pervading life in space. And breathe in. Purify and revivify me. Hold your breath while thinking, and I pray. Then release with an exhale. Heal my body, heart, and soul. And again, breathing in. Beloved Lord Almighty God, breathe out through the rays of the sun. Breathe in through the waves of the air and out through the all-pervading life in space. In, purify and revivify me. Hold, and I pray, release and exhale, heal my body, heart, and soul. And breathing in, beloved Lord Almighty God, and out through the rays of the sun, in through the waves of the air, and out through the all-pervading life and space, in, purify and revivify me, hold, and I pray, exhale. Heal my body, heart, and soul. So, continue to reside in the breath. And be well informed that this practice can clear away the dark chambers of one's mind and heart to illuminate the shrine that is ultimately within, the altar, the temple of God. And not only that, with the exhale, casting that light before us to illuminate our path. And as Hazratanai Khan said earlier today in that first teaching, and now it will get woven back into that, he said to us, inspiration comes from the light thrown upon a certain idea. This comes from the radiance of the breath falling upon the mind. It falls upon the mind like a searchlight and shows to the intelligence the object of its search as things seen in daylight. Thus man knows without any effort on the part of the brain all that he wishes to know and expresses in the way each individual is qualified to do so. When far-reaching, the light that the breath throws upon the mind is in every case different in its radiance. When far-reaching, it illuminates the deep corners of the heart where the light has never reached. And if breath reaches further, the light is thrown upon the mind of God, the store of all the knowledge there is. And hopefully the practice helps to illuminate that a bit. Of course, it isn't realized in one session, but it's realized in one session after many and many, many times of doing it.
seen again once realized. Or, I mean, you can't really say in words what's realized.
Yes. I don't think you could say in a few words, but I think the self becomes realized. And the self is, you know, it sounds presumptuous to say. I mean, Ahalaj was crucified and flayed for saying that God and self are one and the same. It's like the lion cub and the lion, misidentified with the sheep. Does that make sense to people? I know it sounds a little crazy, but in truth, that's what it is. How could it be anything other than? I remember one time I had been invited, God, this was in 1990. As a designer, I was invited to speak at this conference called Eurographics. It's a very high-end technology conference in Switzerland. And there were these NASA engineers there and people that were doing, you know, all this modeling of human motions and virtual reality. But this was in the 1990s, and that was almost 20 years ago. But this was a very advanced conference. All these, and you know, I was kind of the artist, designer person, talking about how technology could have its influence there. And I remember one of the people that was an organizer of the conference was also in charge of an exhibition of design work done with computers and art. And I had several pieces in that exhibition, so he was sort of aware of me before I arrived. And he and a group of other dignitaries that were organizers of the conference had taken me to dinner. And this man, Daniel Bernard, who I'm friends with, Cabri has met him because he's flown to meet us en route to India from Switzerland. He's met us in Amsterdam. He said to me, well, tell me a little bit about what you do. And I looked at him and I said, do you want to know what I do or do you want to know who I am? Now, little did I know that his father worked for the World Health Organization and he spent his first 8 years of life in India. So he understood very well what I was saying. And we have become lifelong friends. We still correspond and talk on the phone and now we talk on Skype. So you see that, and you know, that's always a good question because I'm not really interested in entertaining anyone with my life story. But I'm interested in letting people see a glimpse and also seeing a glimpse of who they are. Right? Does that make sense to people? We spend a lot of time sort of going through our litany of resumes. But that's not really who we are. That's the misidentification of the self. I mean, it can be an indication, however. And I'll just say this, and I hope you don't think this as prideful, Diane or anyone else, but I'll share something with you from the last few weeks. Much to my surprise and through no effort of my own, I was acknowledged in a very high way through my professional organization. Some of you, I think you got probably an email, those in the inner circle, and some photos of that event. It's one of the very highest honors that can be given to a designer. And right before I left to receive that award, there was an awards banquet in New York and then also one in local in Kansas City. And before I left for the one here, Hidayat Inayat Khan, the son of this man, Hazrat Inayat Khan, he lives in Holland and he's 90 years old now, he called and sort of wished luck before we left for this banquet. And he said, you know, these things maybe don't mean that much, but in truth I will tell you what my father always said. He said, the accomplishments of one one's external life is a reflection of the accomplishments on one's internal life. You see, that's where the mirror starts to come into play. The inner world starts to resonate and manifest outwardly. And when you said we create our own reality in a way, Melody, when you said that in a way, that's true. That vibration, I inhale divine light and life, and I radiate the same. Does that make sense to people? This is such a precious human life. It's not enough just to survive, I don't think. I mean, animals do that, but is that how we live? But hopefully to do the, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, well, if you can't help people, at least don't harm them. But if you can help them, that's also good. But how can we help someone else if we can't help ourselves? So we learn through, we do learn through doing somehow, both in the inner world and in the outer world.
Yeah. Something that I read recently that made an impact that he said as well is that renunciation. You don't renunciate from having said I can't. So it's only the only true renunciation is after totally achieved. And then.
That's very true. That was in the Bolasaki this week, and that is so true because he says renunciation in that way is weakness. Renunciation when you've accomplished something, then you say I renounce it. That's strength. That's courage. Wow. Some reactions to that in the room. But you know, it's true, and I love Ram. You know, Ram Dass keeps coming up a lot. You know, I don't know if you know, he was one of the students, principal disciples of Neem Karoli Baba. And, you know, of course, he was very accomplished. You know, he was a scholar at Harvard and in psychology, I think, wasn't he? And, you know, then he went on his spiritual quest, and he says it this way very simply: you got to be somebody before you can be nobody.
That's really pretty deep. Get you kind of.
Yeah. And I think he's also said you have to have something to give up before you give it up. That's real sacrifice. Now, someone's phone up there is just vibrating itself to pieces. Do you know who that might be?
It's mine, and I'm very sorry.
It's okay. Just, can you want to go get it and turn it off?
No,
will it stop?
I had it on
no, it's upstairs. Somebody's upstairs. Or is
no,
it there?
It's
and
not
I'm
not
hearing
upstairs.
It reflecting.
It's just going crazy. That's not very silent, is it?
They're not. They vibrate, and you can hear them. Are there any other comments or questions before we move to the next practice? Now, I want to set this next practice up because we've been doing it, but I want to talk a little bit more about it. This is the next practice. You will notice the sequence of the breaths will be very similar to the last sequence. But now we'll be concentrating in a very different way. We'll be working with the earth, water, fire, air, and the etheric breath. And you're going to be asked to try as you can, and those that have been doing it will feel a little more capable. You just start. You try to start doing this and practice this. And, you know, you practice it, and then you get better at it. But we're going to direct our eyes to certain places at the tip of the nose, the bridge of the nose, the forehead, the crown, and above. And the eyes, with eyes closed, will be directed to those points. Now, why? I wish I had could show you this. I mean, this is a picture of your brain. Then I need another one that lights up that says, and this is your picture of your brain after the elemental practices. But the point is that by doing, it's true. You know, isn't that great? Shouldn't I have something like that? Great. There is, and I'm going to pull out my handout again. I'm referencing my handy-dandy practice guide here for the elemental breaths. So the first, and if you are very calm, let's just do it for a minute. Put your eyes closed, and without doing anything, make your eyes, and if you have to slightly open your eyes, make your eyes go towards the tip of your nose. You may even look a little cross-eyed. What do you feel happening in your head? Do you notice a sensation anywhere?
It cools.
Anything else?
Emptiness.
Any particular sensation at a particular point in the head? And if so, can you tell me where?
Well, it's draining.
Okay, make your eyes go farther down. You can even open your eyes slightly and just make them go really straight down. Feel. Tell me where you feel it.
Back in the head.
Mm-hmm. You feel it in the back of your head?
Oh, yeah. I do.
Do it again and see if you can feel it there. Bring your awareness. You feel it? It's like right here at the base of the skull. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you feel it? Mm-hmm. See, sometimes, and on a Megan, you might be used to meditating and making the eyes go. I do that naturally. Even when I sleep, the tongue goes to the roof and the mm-hmm. eyes go up. So, you know, I have to really work on with this practice. But you'll feel it there. There is a reason. This is where the nerves come up through the spinal column. They say the Kundalini energy, that life force, raises up. Boom. It stimulates this part of the brain, the parasympathetic part of the brain, right? There's a reason why we're doing our eyes in these funny ways. It's actually doing something to the neurological, you know, really like the brainstem there. It's drawing the energy up. It's getting it ready to make its further journey. Okay, so we're concentrating there. The gent energy comes up. I'm interested, David, can you feel that? Because you're sensitive to the flow of Kundalini. Can you feel it back there?
Yeah, because that's where it starts, right? And sometimes there's a little stress.
There can be. And if we can't, if we get stuck with this energy, it will cause headaches and things. Then you'll know what's going on. You can start to breathe and move the energy. So now the next one is as if, and again, if you have to, just open your eyes slightly and look crossed. But, you know, maybe you can do it very subtly. Look at this part of the nose right here and see what, if that sensation moves somewhere. And if it does, where has it moved to? Just concentrate your breath there and your eyes there until you'll notice there's a shift.
I think it's more the front, right here.
Okay. Anyone else?
Maybe more on the side.
It can start to move to more of the center of the head. Mm-hmm. And in that area, I'll use my visual aid, not that you can see it. It's the limbic system. Okay, so this is where the thalamus, the hypothalamus, the pineal gland, all of those things are coming into play. So back here, this is the area where we want to stimulate it, and we want to nurture it. Because if that's not nurtured, that's when imbalances can come into all of the survival parts of our being. You know, so we want to balance that. We want to support it and nourish it. In the limbic system, you know, this is the part that emits growth hormones, that emits hormones that give us a sense of well-being, that balances the moods. It's probably the part that any kind of psychiatric drugs, do you know in your field, do you work with, probably helps with those parts of the brain to nurture them. It probably helps raise the melatonin levels and things like that. Yeah, so we're stimulating that. This isn't like, oh God, she's telling us to look cross-eyed at the tip of our nose and the blah blah blah. I mean, there's a reason for this, you know. I mean, it's not like hoogee woogee woo woo woo. We're gonna all start flying on our magic carpets. Something's happening here. Okay, so now we're gonna do it, and we're gonna be like we're looking, we're raising our eyes, and we're gonna be concentrating here at the forehead. Do you feel it? I mean, I sort of feel a flow of energy come up, and I'm starting to feel, sometimes you feel a pressure or a pulse here. Okay? Now, this frontal lobe is very important because this is the area you can see in the field of neuroscience. They're noticing that really those amazing meditators, I mean, they're hooking these monks up, Tibetan monks up, and they're scanning their brains, and there are certain areas that start to get thickened. And those areas have to do with areas that, again, have to do with various kinds of perceptions, heightened awareness, maybe even spatial sort of relationships. But there's also one particular area in the left frontal lobe that becomes thickened. And that's a very good thing because that's the part that gets thin when people start to get dementia or Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So meditating helps. We're doing brain exercises in a way. And allowing the energy to flow and nourish those parts of the brain. So, you know, it's not just gray matter. There's something that's going on up there, and we can actually use the energy to help nourish that, okay? And then the last one is this, we're concentrating our eyes upwards, farther to the crown. Can anyone describe that feeling they're having, sensation they're having there? All the way up to the crown.
Lightning.
Oh, that's an interesting way of describing it. Do it again. What are you saying?